Welcome to Motivated to Lead podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingsheim.
Hi, everyone. Thanks again for joining us for our podcast this week. My name is Mark Klingsheim with SEMA Partners. Each week, we interview leaders and they share lessons learned from their careers. Our goal is to help you become a better leader. If you're new to our podcast, welcome. I encourage you to go back and listen to some of our previous episodes. This week, we're going to be spending some time with Ryan Quinn. Ryan is the chair of an associate professor in the management entrepreneurship department at the University of Louisville's College of Business. He's also the academic director for the Center for Positive Leadership. He conducts research, teaches, and consults on topics related to leadership and change management, and he's co-authored the book, Lift, The Fundamental State of Leadership. He's taught at all levels, including executive, PhD, MBA, and undergraduate, and has consulted around the world for Fortune 500 companies, private firms, startup businesses, nonprofits, and government institutions. Looking forward to today's conversation with Ryan. I guess, first off, can you give us just a little bit of your career history, a little bit of your story?
Sure. So, I am an associate professor and chair of the management and entrepreneurship department at the University of Louisville in the College of Business. And I'm also the academic director for the Center for Positive Leadership here at the university. I began my academic career by getting my PhD at the University of Michigan. I finished that in 2003. And from there, I went to Washington University in St. Louis, the Darden School at the University of Virginia. I did a year visiting position at the Marriott School in Brigham Young University, and then I've been here at the University of Louisville for the past 10 years.
Okay, great. So I like to ask this question of most every guest, and you're dealing with a lot of people in probably this age group or stage of life. But if you were to go back and talk to a 22-year-old Ryan, knowing what you know now, what advice would you give him?
Let's see. Let me see if I can distill it. So first thing I think I would say is slow down and do it right. Be patient. It will all work out, and it doesn't work any better if you're rushing and you're stressed. And so I think that I would have done a better job on many things if I had given myself that advice and taken that advice earlier on. Sure. Another one is, and this might be more for, I don't know how much this fits across fields. In my field, I would have told myself, let yourself be put in a box. So everybody, when I was a young beginning PhD student working to become a professor, you know, said you need to choose a box to put yourself in. And by that, they meant a topic area that you have expertise in. And I hated the idea of putting myself in a box. And so I resisted and resisted. And in fact, it actually was a good idea. I probably should have done it. And it didn't, you know, when you do it, what I learned is it doesn't constrain you in as much as you think it will. It actually enables you to do a lot of things that I couldn't see at the time. So I would give myself that advice. And I also might, even if I could go back even further to like high school, I might tell myself that English and math are more important than you think they are.
So any advice you received early on that you, looking back on it, you should have ignored?
You know, the biggest one for what I would have ignored is when I began my profession in the PhD program, everyone in my department, all of the professors told me, don't study leadership. And I wanted to study leadership, and I was really disappointed by that advice, but eventually I gave in and took that advice. And then a couple of years after I left with my PhD, the topic of leadership came back into vogue. Everybody was studying it again. And if I had actually studied it instead of listening to people, then I would have been a year or two ahead of the curve, and you know, it would have had this huge impact, right? So that was I do think it was good advice to say, you know, let people put you in a box, but I shouldn't have let other people choose my box for me.
Yeah, great advice. So the whole topic of leadership, and you've spent a lot of time as far as in studying leadership and taking a look at real life examples and kind of how leaders can definitely impact an organization and move things forward. A lot of our listeners are kind of in that first time leadership position, or their first time CEOs. Talk about just some of the thoughts you have around moving from that kind of that peer relationship into a leadership position. And a lot of times that's what happens. You're doing well in your position. You get tapped on the shoulder and they say, you know, we see some leadership qualities in you. Now you're going to be leading people that before were peers. How should somebody approach that as a new leader?
Yeah, so it's a great question. And I actually think the question's a little bit different for somebody who's entering their first supervisory position to someone who's like gone from being, say, a member of the C-suite to becoming the CEO.
Right, sure.
Because what they have in common is that in both positions, the people who were your peers are now your subordinates. And so you have to manage that relationship. What's different is that there are a lot of expectations people have when they move from the entry-level position to a supervisory position that most people in the C-suite don't have those expectations, the same thing. So one of the best articles that I know of that was written on this topic is actually kind of a classic from HBR now, was written by Linda Hill. And so she noticed, like, when people move to these first supervisory positions, that they come in with a lot of false beliefs. So, for example, you know, one of the beliefs is now I have the authority to implement my ideas that I've been promoted. And then you get in the position and you realize actually there's a lot of skepticism and you've got to earn that respect. And, you know, you've got to learn to work interdependently with people. And that comes as a surprise, because when you're at the bottom looking up, it looks like these people have this authority and this power. And so you make incorrect assumptions about what it's going to be like when you get there. And so knowing that ahead of time and preparing yourself can be really important. Another idea that comes up with that is the idea that with that authority, I can tell people what to do, when in fact, even if you get people to comply with you, compliance is not the same as getting people committed and interested and invested in what you're doing. And the second option, that commitment, takes a lot more work than compliance does. Sure. There's also this idea, like, when you're at the bottom, you think about your relationship with your boss. But when you become the boss, it's not just the individual relationships. You have to think about your whole team and how the team works, and not just your relationships with the individual members of the team. So those are just a few of the examples of the kinds of things that you have to think about in a supervisory position. Whereas moving from any position and you get promoted up and then you have to start managing people who are your peers, then you have to think about that relationship has changed. And one of the things that's hard about that is there's, when you have authority over people, there's always a little bit of distance between you and them. And if you were friends, for example, it's the friendship is not going to be exactly the same as it was before. And you can work it really hard and build that friendship up and get it close. I like to, if you think about in math, they have this idea of the asymptotic relationship, where you get closer and closer to the number, or closer and closer to zero, but you never can get 100% there. As a leader, you can push, you know, and get really close to where the relationship is almost back to that number again, but you'll never get 100% there, because that authority will always stand just a little bit in your way. And so, first of all, that's one reason to be careful about, do you want that position of leadership? A lot of times, down looking up, the leadership position looks really appealing. And then you get in there and you realize there's some things that aren't as appealing about it. It reminds me, when we were living in Charlottesville, the elementary school that our kids attended started having some challenges. And so my wife and I decided to get involved and help out. I brought in some MBA teams to do some consulting. My wife started volunteering with the PTO. But what she discovered when she started volunteering with the PTO is that there was actually a leadership vacuum in the PTO. And pretty soon she got sucked into that vacuum. And she kept telling everybody she wasn't the president of the PTO. And finally, one of her friends took her aside and said, "Amy, you might as well let people call you that, because that's what everybody thinks you are." And And she would, for that year, like at least twice a week, I would get into bed at night and she would turn and look at me and she would say, why would anybody want to be a leader? Like, why? Is it the money? Is it the power? Why would anyone want this? And I think that that's the part that people often don't think about before they get put into a leadership position, and what it does to your friendships and the responsibility it puts on you, and a lot of stuff that you don't think about when you're down looking up.
So talk about a little bit the difference between management and leadership. There's always that, you know, that whole, you know, what is the differences, you know, how does somebody move again from the manager? Can you be a manager and a leader, or are they two different things that somebody should be aware of as far as the differences?
Yeah. So that actually gets to what we were talking about a minute ago, the difference between compliance and commitment. Mm-hmm. I do want to say before we distinguish them, what often happens when people try to distinguish between management and leadership is they tend to make one sound good and the other sound bad. And usually it's leadership that sounds good because you're inspiring and motivating people, and management is the one that ends up sounding bad because you're using your authority to get their compliance and whatever else. And I want to just say right up front, management is not bad. We would not have the organizations that we have today that can build the incredible things and deliver the incredible services that we have today if it wasn't for management, right? So what matters is less about is management good or bad, and more about are you a good manager when you manage? And the fact is that even if you hardly ever lead or never lead, you can still make a serious positive contribution by being a good manager. That's my caveat that you probably weren't asking for, but I wanted to throw in there before I said it.
Yeah.
So I define management and leadership this way, and I think it's largely consistent with how most people do it. Everybody has a little tweak or a variation on the theme, but management is about using data, systems, logic, and authority to make requests of people to organize their behavior. And that's really what management is. It's basically the person who takes the responsibility of organizing things. So what's interesting is you don't have to have a formal position to manage, but you know, it's often easier to do so because you have authority in a formal position. And so that management is simply about coordination, and how well you manage often depends on how well you do your analysis, how much logic you use, how polite you are when you make those requests, those kinds of things. So management is often about using the existing social norms and routines and expectations and helping people execute on them. Leadership, on the other hand, is often about changing the social norms and the routines and rather than executing on them, inspiring people to go another way. And the problem is that when we deviate from social norms and expectations, there's always risk, because deviating from these things means people are going to be uncomfortable. They're going to feel uncertain. There's going to be difficulty, just the work that goes into doing change and having to change thought patterns and behavior patterns. And so at the Center for Positive Leadership, we really emphasize deviating with virtues. So virtues meaning the standards of excellence in moral expectations, such as courage, compassion, honesty, humility, curiosity, these standards that we expect of people when they're at their best. And when you deviate with virtue, you decrease the risk of people not wanting to follow you, and you increase the chance of inspiring people to want to follow you. And so we often train people to pause and ask different questions of what would it look like to be exceptionally courageous in this situation? What would it look like to be exceptionally ambitious? And when we actually ask ourselves and answer those questions, we change how we think and feel and behave, and we do things that are more likely to inspire people to follow rather than to just do it out of compliance.
What are some of the things, there's been books written about the first 90 days in a leadership position. There's been a lot that has been made as far as around that, kind of how do you set yourself up for success in that, you know, first period of time, whatever they define it as. What are some thoughts that you have for a new leader that's coming in? What are some of the things that you would put as the highest priorities as far as that somebody should be thinking about?
That's interesting. I was thinking along one track until you got to the end of your question and you asked about highest priorities. And I guess I would answer this abstractly, because I think the answer is going to be so different depending on what the situation of the organization is when you take on a certain position. For example, if I take over an organization or a segment of an organization that's been floundering, then what I need to accomplish in the first 90 days is very different from when I take over some organization or section thereof that has been humming efficiently and so forth. And there's a million other things too, right? Like what you do in a political organization is going to be different from what you do in a for-profit corporation and a nonprofit and so forth. That being said, I think the reason why people are generally concerned with those first 90 days or first 100 days is because they're thinking about first impressions and credibility and being able to continue effectively after those first 90 or 100 days are over. And so I would probably divide it into thinking about managing internally and managing externally. I have to develop credibility with the people over whom I have authority, so that they are comfortable following my authority or willing to follow me in the leadership things that I do, and that I have their trust, and therefore we're able to move along and hum. And when I ask them to do something, they're more willing to do it. And so establishing trust is critical there. But I think that what often happens, especially at the lower levels of management and organization, is that we often forget about the external or upward management that is also critical in those first 90 or 100 days, because those are the people who are up, or the customers who are outside, or the donors who are outside, or whatever else, are the people who are going to determine whether I have the resources to continue and succeed after those days. Usually the people below me don't control my resources that I have to act with. And so I have to get viability and trust and legitimacy with them as well. I like the dimensions of trust. I don't remember the scholars who first identified them, so I have to get back to you on that. But they identified, and others have come up with different ones, but I like these. They say that trust comes down to competence, integrity, and benevolence. And so I could trust that you're a competent person who acts with integrity, but if I don't think you like me and care about me, then I'm not going to trust you to do the things that I need and want in my position, right? And similarly, if I think you care about me and you're competent, but you're a nasty character who's dishonest, right? Then there's things I'm not going to trust you to do. And so when you're in those first 90 to 100 days and you're establishing credibility with both internal and external constituents, I think the thing that I need to constantly come back to is, am I being benevolent to those people and do they see me doing so? Am I acting with integrity and can they see me doing so? Or if they can't see me, am I communicating it? Am I helping them to see it? And that's the part a lot of times people assume, that if I'm doing it, they should see it and understand. Not necessarily. There's a lot of people who can't see what you're doing, right? And so you've got to both exhibit benevolence, integrity, and competence, but then you also have to make sure that people see it and understand it if you want that credibility and trust.
What are to take the pulse to see whether you're coming across that way, you know, as far as competence, integrity, benevolence is probably the one that's maybe the hardest to figure out, if are people seeing me that way. But what are some questions you think a leader can ask, or ways that they can measure whether they're coming across that way?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because asking and measuring concepts like benevolence, integrity, and competence. Competence is the easiest, right? Because you can actually just look at performance and you get some idea, whatever your definition of performance is in your organization, in your position, you should be able to get at least some indicator of that. The other two are a lot harder. And part of the reason they're harder is, even if you ask them or if you use some measures, people, if they don't trust you, they may not give you honest answers.
Yeah, right. Yep.
And so I think the other thing that I would do to try to help myself get honest answers is identify people early on in the process that I can specifically focus on as both confidants, but also people who will tell me what I'm doing wrong, right? I had a colleague once who called them your nasty friends, the friends who are willing to tell you whatever it is, you know, and I think you've got to establish that early on. Who are these people going to be who are actually will have a pulse of the organization, who other people will talk to, you know, and give them their sense of it. And then make sure that if I fail at establishing trust with everyone else, at least I succeed with these, you know, one, two, three people who can be the ones who can be a check on whether the data I'm getting back from people really is accurate about how people feel. And so if I have that, then I can do things like I can send out a survey, and there's all kinds of great measures on various dimensions of trust that, you know, could be included in a survey. There's, you know, you could go out and do focus groups and ask people, so what are we doing well? What are we doing poorly? What, you know, should we do differently? Those kinds of questions. And then when you collect that data, whatever form it's in, then you can go take it to your nasty friends and say, all right, help me interpret this. Am I doing this right? You know, whatever else. And the fact that you're even putting effort into this usually shows, and people are going to be responsive to it, unless they give you that initial feedback and you don't use it. And then you'll have burned all your bridges at that point. Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. So you continue to learn and grow. And are there some books that you recommend to other leaders that you think are important?
Yeah. So these are ones that I'm sure there are other great ones out there, but I'll give you a few that I think are excellent and continue to influence both my my own management and leadership and also my scholarship. So I like Leadership and Self-Deception by the Arbinger Institute. Another one that I think is great is Adam Grant's book that came out during the pandemic, Think Again. The Roger Connors and Tom Smith have a book called Change the Culture, Change the Game, which does a fabulous job of taking culture change and making it something you feel you can actually put your hands on and feel practical about. I like Richard Rumelt's book, Good Strategy, Bad Strategy. I find that particularly useful because when I work with people on strategy, I'm amazed at how often people want to just post hoc label what we're doing as our strategy instead of actually plan out, here's how we're going to win in the marketplace, and then go do it, even if it's scary and requires us to make changes. I like the Chip and Dan Heath's book, Switch, and Ben Horowitz's The Hard Thing About Hard Things will be another one that I think is really well done. And I go back to again and again, like these other ones.
Okay, great. Yeah, definitely some new ones on the list there. Any favorite quotes that you like?
You know, this is of all the things that you mentioned that you might ask me ahead of time, this one was the hardest one. I'm a religious person, so I actually have a lot of scriptures memorized. So I do those a lot of times as well. So, but I was also trying to think of some secular ones and, you know, and so I really actually struggled with this question a lot. I do, like, the one that came to mind this morning is the one that used to be attributed to Einstein, but now I think people are questioning if he really did say it or not. It was the one about there's two ways to see the world. You can see it as nothing being a miracle or seeing everything be a miracle. And I think, you know, that's not something we normally bring up with leadership, but I think when you're in a managerial position, what you see determines a lot of what happens in the organization. And so, you know, what you're looking for matters, you know, but back on the scriptural side, the one I love that I think is very pertinent to what we've talked about today, it says, we have learned by sad experience that is the nature and disposition of almost all men and women that as soon as they gain a little authority, as they suppose, they will immediately begin to exercise unrighteous dominion. And I think that's a really nice warning for all of us.
What parting advice would you give a new leader?
Parting advice. I would say, you know what? I guess I would stick with that other quote and say, if you look for the good things will grow. Doesn't mean you shouldn't look for the bad things. I also simultaneously believe in the title of Andy Grove's book, Only the Paranoid Survive. But I think that you can do both, right? And stay paranoid and look for all the things that could go wrong. But then equally, if not more important, is look for the good and the good will grow.
Well, Ryan, this has been a lot of fun. And I definitely wish you continued success as you teach leaders and you help organizations grow and develop. How would somebody learn more about your work and what you're doing as far as your writing?
Well, let's see. So one thing to do, we have a new website coming out for the Center on Positive Leadership, but it's still a couple of weeks away. And so if your listeners hear this, just wait a couple of weeks and then go to our website. And that will be at positiveleadership.louisville.edu. And you'll find a lot of stuff there, including some of my own work and publications, you know, that are available from there.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.